Welcome to the Math Ed Podcast. My name is Sam Otten from the University of Missouri, and today I'm joined by two guests who are co-authors together. It's Kathy Sun, who's an associate professor at Santa Clara University in the Department of Education. Kathy, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
And also Jennifer Roof, who's an associate professor at the University of Oregon in the Department of Education Studies. Jenny, thanks for being here as well.
Sam, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, great to have you back on the pod, but you're bringing friends this time, so it's a lot of fun. So Kathy and Jenny have recently published an article in the Journal of Mathematical Behavior, and that article is entitled Examining and Conceptualizing the Relationship Between Teacher Praise and the Co-Construction of Mathematical Competence in Classrooms. So we get to dig into some teacher praise and some mathematical meaning making. So this is some good stuff. I want to start with the teacher praise side of things. Where did you first sort of get interested in studying, and where did that originate from, a focus on teacher praise?
So Kathy and I are both longtime educators, and we're math teachers before earning our doctorate. And while we were students together at Stanford, we actually shared an office. And we also co-taught some of the methods classes. And I have many happy memories of being locked in a windowless office with Kathy for hours, digging into problems of practice and what we were going to do about it in class. And so this paper really emerged out of both of our dissertations, and we were looking at different aspects of math education, and we thought it would be wonderful to continue our work together. And so it made sense to take a look at what Kathy had studied and what I had studied and where they started to intersect. And the more we dug into the data, the more we got interested in the role that teacher praise was playing.
Yeah, and I think the joke is we just wanted to write a paper together. No, I'm just kidding. We just really enjoy working together. And I think part of that is what Jenny said about building off of our work. And in my work, I primarily looked at teaching and how teachers support growth mindset through their instruction. And one of the elements in social psychology is looking at types of praise. And Jenny's work looking at kind of normative identity and what that means to be good at math, we thought, hey, let's combine these two areas together, because while the praise literature tends to be more social psychology focused, we really wanted to bring that idea into mathematics teaching in classrooms. And so trying to understand the nuance on how does praise contribute to what students think is it means to be good at math in their respective classroom context. And so I think it really integrated both of our areas of expertise together, looking at that kind of growth mindset aspect, but really tying it specifically to mathematics education. And so it's also just fun to be able to work with your colleagues. And then the other piece about praise is we were thinking, oh, it's something small that we could work on. And we tend to both be in mathematics teacher education and work with both pre-service and in-service teachers. And a lot of teachers were asking, like, what do I say when a kid says something? And we thought, that's a space where praise could really come in. So there was an applied aspect to it too, which is for both me and Jenny really important, coming as former math, high school math teachers, to really want to have something that's applicable and that we could work with and support our teachers to do.
Mm-hmm. And just as we get started here to make sure we're sort of on the same page, could you give some examples of teacher praise, or maybe some of the teacher praise that you saw in your data that helped you sort of know there's going to be something here if we look at it more closely?
Yeah. And so I mentioned earlier about social psychology kind of really having a general view on praise. So they have things like person-based praise, which is kind of Carol Dweck's work around mindset. And when we praise people for person-based attributes, like you're so smart or you're so fill in the adjective. And that's one type of praise that teachers might say, you're so smart. And then there's kind of process-based praise, which in the social psych literature classifies it as things you can do, right? You put in so much hard work. And a lot of that was happening in math classrooms, but it was kind of math neutral, right? So teachers were trying to stay away from person-based praise, saying you're so smart. And then they were saying things like you're doing such a good job, but that was kind of generic and in process. But that was kind of what we were noticing in classrooms. And so we thought, let's try to hone in around specific types of praise. And that kind of builds off of Lisa Jilk's work and the work of complex instruction from Elizabeth Cohen and Rachel Lotan around assigning competence, right? Saying something specific about what a kid has done. For example, I noticed you did such a good job asking this question that helped your group do something. And so we were kind of trying to figure out a frame for understanding what types of praise are teachers giving in math classrooms, and what does that mean for students and the teacher and the context for what it means to be good at math?
And is the praise usually even if it's not person-based, is it still sort of in the direction of one student? Or could it also be sometimes where it's praising like the whole class? Like, I like that whole discussion that we just had, or I like the way that we all tackled this problem together. So could it also be kind of collective praise?
Yeah, and we found both. I mean, typically praise was directed toward an individual student, sometimes to a group, especially in the classes that were using complex instruction, and also sometimes the whole class. And that's going to come back around when we discuss normative identity a bit as well.
So in this space, and it's also very cool to see that you did this analysis kind of across two studies or across two data sets, and you're like, hey, let's put them together. Let's kind of look at some themes across them. But what did you set out as your main purpose for this study? Like, what question could you answer, or what could it accomplish by working on this together?
Yeah, I think our main goal was really to understand and do an in-depth analysis of praise, because like I had mentioned in the social psychology literature, the buckets were kind of person-based praise, generic praise, process-based praise. And we really wanted to see specifically what are teachers praising related to mathematics, right? So both social norms and mathematical norms, which I think Jenny will talk about as we talk about our construct of what mathematical competence could look like. And then I think we also recognize there's lots of ways that teachers can contribute to what it means to be good at math. And we felt like praise, and this is from our teaching background, was more of like a low-hanging fruit type practice that we could work on as teacher educators to support our teachers and our teacher candidates to hone their noticing skills. So we're kind of building off the work of Miriam Sharon. Like, if we focus on how do we praise, it would help teachers to focus on student thinking and noticing particular aspects of doing and thinking about mathematics. And so from a practitioner perspective, we thought, hey, this is something that's doable. And many of my students were asking me in my math methods class about, so what do I say? Like, how do I affirm what they've done in a way that's meaningful? And I said, oh, that's kind of interesting. And so they kind of seeded in us kind of this idea of, hey, this is something that we could actually study and give people a kind of a systematic analysis of the ways that praise could happen. And so that kind of brought us to this work. And we were hoping that it would kind of situate research and practice, right? This research contributing to how praise contributes to what it means to be good at math, but then also really giving teachers an outline and a structure for the types of ways that they can praise in their own classrooms as well.
For both Kathy and I, well, Kathy, you can affirm if this is true or not. I'm going to try speaking for both of us, but especially because our roots are as classroom teachers, both of us continue to be motivated by what happens with and for kids in math classrooms. And that's actually really helpful in the academic world where there are so many demands on our times and often distractions. And so if we're not going to be in the classrooms working with kids directly, one of the things that's especially important to me is that my work continues to support kids in classrooms and teachers. So one of the beautiful things, and frankly, one of the more intense things about writing this paper, were the number of hours that we spent poring over data in a way that no classroom teacher would ever have the time. So I hope that this work is in some small way, at least a gift of a very close look at a very small piece of what's happening in real time in a lot of classrooms. And just to reiterate, as Kathy said, that perhaps praise can be a low demand, but high impact kind of practice that people can look at.
So moving into the study, I was just going to ask how you conceptualize some of the main things. So we've talked a little bit about teacher praise. If there's anything else you need to add to the sort of theoretical framing of praise, you could add that here. But I also want you to comment a little bit on how you thought about normative identity and how that came into this study.
I'll take normative identity. That was my embracing of that framework came out of the dissertation work that I was doing. So my dissertation was really looking at one math classroom. It was three classes, but they were all taught by the same teacher. And I wanted to get a sense of what was going on in that math classroom that created a culture that supported so many kids in doing well in mathematics. So I proposed, you know, I started with a teacher who was doing really cool work already and was teaching using complex instruction, which was an important component. Because in terms of this paper, complex instruction sets teachers up to be using assigning competence as a form of praise. Anyway, my whole point is that the more I looked at what was going on in the classroom, the more I had the sense of, if you walked into that room and you asked just about anybody, any kid, how do you know if somebody's good at math? They would be able to tell you. And that was actually what I was collecting as data, not knowing it was going to fit with that framework later on. So a brief overview of normative identity, I think of it as how does the community of that classroom recognize what it means to be good at math? Normative identity comes from Cobb, Grisolfi, and Hodges' work. This is a 2009 paper. One important thing to note is that it is a co-construction between teachers and students. So every action that takes place in that classroom is contributing to both explicit and implicit agreements on how and how we're going to do math together and how we will be socially together. So when you look at normative identity, you can think of two intersecting sets of norms. One set is around, how do you know if someone is a good citizen or a good colleague? Do they share what they understand? Do they share materials? Are they warm and inviting in those ways? And then how do you understand somebody as mathematically competent? So for example, do they justify their answers? Do they ask good questions? Are they comfortable, you know, being brave about what they do and don't know yet? And to be clear, you can, you know, normative identities are going to vary. They're going to be different in every single classroom because they are a cultural co-construction. And it's possible to have a normative identity where being good at math is you never have a wrong answer. You're always fast to answer. Sort of the more traditional and problematic framings of what it means to be good at math, sort of the sort of inherent smartness and the fear of being wrong. But, you know, like what I was seeing in the classroom that I was studying was much more what I was describing earlier about being helpful, being brave, using mathematical terminology and drawings to help other people understand and to connect ideas. So just to sum that up, normative identity is how you know if you're good at math, and how you know if somebody's good at math is based on their observable behaviors in the classroom, both as a good colleague and as showing mathematical competence. And so teacher praise becomes really important because the teacher is a huge contributor to deciding what it means to be good at math in that classroom, especially in the middle school grades.
Yeah, I think you said it really well. And I think part of it is recognizing that it's co-constructed, right? So the teacher does contribute and then students can kind of also contribute. But in certain classrooms, it's more co-constructed than other classrooms, right? So it depends on who kind of has that authoritative lens in it. And so we were interested in examining different types of classrooms where they follow different pedagogical strategies, two of the teachers ascribing to complex instruction, because we thought there were particular norms and values around kind of distribution of authority and power in the class and the co-construction, and then more kind of what we might call traditional math classrooms that have more direct instruction. And so we really want to see if there would be similarities or differences across different structures of teaching.
Yeah, which leads perfectly to my next question, which was going to be about the context and the classrooms, because this study was kind of unique in how it looks back at prior data from other studies, but now you sort of analyze them with these new research questions in mind. And they're from diverse middle schools in California. But I just wonder, you know, people can look at the article for details, but as we listen here to your results coming up next, your findings, what should we keep in mind about the data and the context of those schools? I know Kathy was just alluding to some of it, and Jenny was alluding to it, but help us just get a little bit more of a sense so that we can interpret your findings.
Well, all right. So a breakdown is that we chose all middle school classrooms, and that was a function of the data that we had. So some of the decisions were made for us a priori because we were using existing data. But then Kathy actually had a number of teachers in her study, and I only had one. So what we did was we ended up setting up pairs. So we had two teachers who use complex instruction. Briefly, complex instruction is the idea of teaching heterogeneously grouped math classes. So not tracked, for example. The students ideally work in small groups. They have roles to help manage issues of status and distributions of agency and authority. And teachers use something called a multiple abilities treatment at the beginning of a task. And very importantly, they attend to status differences with using what's called assigning competence by specifically naming some mathematical contribution that a student might have made and doing it in a public way. Ideally, in those circumstances, then students within the group and within the classroom are going to value what the teacher has flagged as important mathematically. And so this is going to support kids who might have low social status within the group or the classroom because they've now got academic status that the teacher has conferred to them. But I digress. Anyway, So we have two teachers who are using complex instruction. They were in different schools. And then we had two teachers who were using more of a gradual release model, initiate response and evaluate sort of questioning. It's much more closer to, you know, like lecture style, what we would traditionally think of as mathematics. Those teachers were in the same school, I believe. In each pair, one of the teachers was relatively new to their career, and the other teacher had been teaching for a number of years. So we had some thoughts about how complex instruction might actually impact praise patterns, and it, as well, the gradual release IRE model. And that was, those were some of the surprises that actually came out of the data. All of these students were attending school, public middle schools within the San Francisco Bay Area. And they were racially, ethnically, and socioeconomically diverse. Many of them, I guess I would just stop with that because it's such a large number of students. And I know a lot about what my, you know, my context and a little bit less about Kathy's. Kathy, is there anything you want to more about, add about the students?
Yeah, I think it was a diverse context. And we would say that many of the students come from traditionally come from schools and messaging where they might not have been designated as being good at mathematics. So we are curious to know how teachers kind of contribute through their praise to change that narrative, right? So what does it mean to be good at mathematics and that to support students to believe that they can be good at mathematics?
Mm-hmm. So let's get into some of the praise patterns. I wanted to start first with like the overall patterns that you saw for the teacher praise, just kind of looking across the whole data set that you analyzed.
Yeah, as expected with any kind of instruction, there's going to be variation across the four teachers, right? So every teacher is going to have their own different praise patterns. But across, like looking broadly, we can kind of cluster like three out of the four teachers did certain things more often. And so, for example, we noticed that three out of the four teachers tended to praise what we call social obligations more. So when we think about normative identity, we broke it into, and this comes from Cobb and colleagues, around social obligations, which is kind of the things we do to be, quote unquote, like a good citizen, I would say, right? So what are the ways we interact socially around the mathematics and the classroom? And so about three out of the four teachers praised these types of obligations more, such as answering a question or being respectful, those kinds of things. Likewise, we also broke our analysis into mathematical obligations, which are the ways of doing and thinking about math, specifically to mathematics. And so these might be more social mathematical norms if we look at that kind of framework. To operationalize that, we looked at the five strands of mathematical proficiency as a way to look at mathematical engagement and then maybe some emergent codes. And we realized that of the five strands, the most common one out of three or four teachers was procedural fluency. So three out of the four teachers really heavily praised being fluent at procedures. And we recognize there's, you know, conceptual understanding, adaptive reasoning, and strategic competence and the like. And those weren't praised as much for three out of the four teachers. And so that was interesting to us because we did think that with complex instruction, we would have a split of two and two, right? The complex instruction might focus more on adaptive reasoning, strategic competence, and conceptual understanding. But one of the teachers did focus heavily on procedural fluency.
But then, like you alluded to, there's always, you know, nuances and idiosyncrasies for different teachers and different styles. So what did you see? If you can kind of just talk about each teacher individually, what were some interesting aspects that arose?
This is one of the places where we had some thoughts about how the different types of pedagogy, complex instruction versus the gradual release, more traditional lecture model might impact praise patterns. And so we, for one thing, I anticipated that especially within complex instruction, we would see more praise for mathematical obligations. And we actually found lots of praise for social obligations. And what that made sense on the back end of it, because complex instruction only works if you have functional small groups. And so making sure that those groups were functioning, that the students were being good colleagues to one another is actually quite important. Another thing that we were pleasantly surprised to find was that we found very different praise patterns within the more traditional style of lecturing. One of my concerns coming into that analysis was that we would see a lot of heavy focus on answering questions and procedures. And we did find that, but we also found, at least with one of the teachers, she was so interested in the students' creativity specifically. So we did find that teachers, you know, like it, some of the teachers were consistent in terms of looking for, they were praising similar things across lessons, and other teachers were varying by lesson. And so one of the things that we were also interested in, and it was a little bit difficult to tease out because we were only looking at four different lessons for each teacher, was how does the lesson content itself maybe predict praise?
Yeah.
You know, if it's a lesson on something especially procedural, it would make sense to see a lot of procedural praise, for example.
Yeah, and I think building off of what Jenny just said about looking at similar lessons, we did have the fortune of having two of our teachers, and this is kind of strategic, who taught in that more traditional route, but they would plan together and they would co-teach, they would plan and then teach their classes separately. And I think building off of what Jenny said, there is variation in that praise, even though the lesson was the same lesson. And that in many ways as a researcher was, give us hope in the sense of, oh, you have this freedom and flexibility in praising. So this teacher that she's alluding to, who we called Miss Frida in the article, kind of opened up the praise, even though the lesson was originally kind of more of an IRE, you know, initiate, respond, evaluate type lesson. There was opportunities by which she was able to praise this creativity or student thinking within that in space. And so even with the same curriculum or the same lesson plan, there's breadth and scope of praise that can happen. Likewise, with the complex instruction, we had two teachers with complex instruction. As I mentioned earlier, one teacher tended to praise procedural fluency more, while one tended to praise strategic competence, right? And so with even within that same kind of pedagogical approach, there's different variation that can happen. And so that, as a teacher educator, tells us that there's opportunities for us to support teachers to praise, quote unquote, better, I guess, right? So there's opportunity, regardless of your curriculum or the structure that your school may adopt in the instruction.
So I'll go back to the joy that co-authoring this paper with Kathy brought to me. It was super fun to do a deep dive into all this data and spend a lot of time looking at it in different ways and playing with it in different ways. And one of the outcomes of all of that work is figure three, which is on page 16 of the article. So I'm just putting in a small plug. If you are actually going to go read the article, you might want to take a look at that picture. It's a Venn diagram showing all four teachers, and it's showing the things that they most praised. And you can see in the looking at that diagram how those praise patterns were shared and differentiated by the teachers. So as a visual model, it's very concise. And that's Kathy's work, just to be clear.
No, it was joint work. We have to brainstorm. Nothing's done in isolation. And so another thing that I think was interesting, just to build off what Jenny said and to highlight, is really this idea of when we think about complex instruction and the importance of attending to group work. And so she mentioned this idea of the social obligations and the intensity and the specificity with teachers praise how to be a good group member or a good colleague, which we kind of broadly defined as social obligations. And so that was a surprise because, as Jenny defined earlier, assigning competence is really a mathematical contribution. So we thought there would be many more mathematical obligations that were praised, but recognizing that both of the teachers, one praised mathematical obligations more than the other. And I think that is just an interesting finding because, and this teacher tended to have a longer tenure at complex instruction. And so we talked about experience being a big part of this too, right? So as you're learning complex instruction, you may tend to praise procedural fluency more because that's kind of the history and the tradition of how many of us experienced mathematics and what we know. But over time, it's possible to kind of grow. And we don't have proof of that, but we see this differential between a kind of a beginner teacher with complex instruction and a more experienced teacher in that regard. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of growing and continuing to think about this, are there some questions that are still on your mind, or is there an idea that has just really still stayed with you even after writing this and publishing it? And what's still on your mind about it?
Yeah, I think when I said earlier that kind of my students brought this to my attention, thinking, you know, how do I better attend to, and we know that person-based praise is bad, how do I better give praise? And so I said, oh, that's a great question. And it made us think about it. And then as Jenny and I were analyzing this, I would have stuff to report back to my students. So I'd say, oh yeah, we're analyzing this, and there's these different ways that teachers are praising. And so what's really stuck in is this idea of specificity of praise. And this builds off of Lisa Jilk's work, right? So when we assign competence, we noticed there was a lot of generic kind of good, good, good. And it's unclear to students sometimes what you're praising, right? So if I say good or good job or good question, we're not sure who we're talking to, but the more level of specificity, good question, did you see how that supported someone to blank, right? And so I've been really kind of thinking about informally working with my teachers and my students around praising with greater specificity. And so I think this is kind of an area of study going forward, is looking at how do we support teachers? Now that we have this analysis, the next step is thinking about how do teachers learn and how do we share this information in a way that supports their learning and their growth? And as Jenny said, I come to this work and we come to this work really because we want to support students in the end. And so that's how do we support teachers? And so possible next steps and studies is playing these out in our methods courses in the co-learning environments we set up with teachers and sharing this information and supporting them to notice and praise better. And so I do some coaching, the new study that I'm working on. And so I've been working on how do I respond and affirm students' actions in these kinds of ways that we outlined in the paper with more specificity, assigning competence and things like that.
One of the things, and I'm going to again attribute this to you, Kathy. I mean, it's not just you, but especially for those of us who are math ed researchers, it's really important to remember that we're allowed into classrooms at the generosity of teachers and students. And so one of the tricky things about writing about a paper like this, where we were anticipating patterns and types of praise and types of instruction that we maybe thought were not the most ideal, is to remember that every teacher walks into that classroom with intentions of being helpful to all of their students, and they're where they're at on their journey. So I just wanted to note that, yes, we saw lots of praise for things like good and good job and things that were maybe less specific, and to normalize, no one's going to have specific praise every single time they do. It's just classrooms are messy ecologies. And so I think it's great that we can learn to better notice and focus and have and set our intentions in those ways. And that's part of the arc of building our craft as educators. And I'm including myself now because I'm forever really a teacher. So with that in mind, the other thing that I'm thinking about is I actually got to go to a conference on complex instruction in September. And it was amazing. There were people there from Brazil and Hungary and Germany and the United States. And Rachel Lotan was there. Actually, it was her conference. So it's not surprising that she was there. But as she was talking about what happens when she goes out into the world and talks with teachers about complex instruction, she'll often hear them talk about, yes, I do heterogeneous group. Yes, I do the group roles. We do group worthy tasks and multiple abilities treatments. And then she'll say, well, what about assigning competence? And that's the thing, that's the piece that just doesn't seem to have landed for lots of teachers for whatever reason. Maybe because it is, you know, it's getting into the guts of power differences and status, and it's tricky. That could be an explanation. I don't know. But what I've been doing in my own methods classes is workshops on how to recognize moments of assigning competence. So if we look at video footage of actual classrooms, I ask students to identify, where do you see a moment where a teacher is identifying a student publicly and praising something that they did that was mathematical? It's a little tricky when you do that because we can't make assumptions about the social status of that kid from watching a video. That would be totally inappropriate. So we just sort of suspend that part of it. We're like just looking at what is the teacher action? And then, as Kathy said, looking at how can teachers actually look for those things in their own classrooms, look for moments where they can assign competence and praise in those ways. I'll add one little piece. I had a nice discussion with Lisa Jilk. This was some years ago at a conference. And, you know, I was talking to her about her 2016 paper on praise specifically. And one of the things that she's finding in her own work is that if you praise a child, a student, and you are not explicit about what it is you are praising them for, especially if that kid's had a bad experience with math, they're likely to reject your praise. They won't find it believable if you don't give a concrete example. So I'll just wrap it all up by saying, yeah, it's great to say good job and to, you know, to have that kind of praise in your classroom, but there is something uniquely powerful about connecting with a kid in a public setting about why explicitly it is that they just did something brilliant in math. And so to look for those moments of brilliance in students and shine a light on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when it's very general, if the student is kind of skeptical of it, it could just be like, well, the teachers are nice. You know, teachers have to be nice, that they're paid to be nice to the student. But if you get specific and you point out, then it's kind of like hard to deny that. It's like, oh wow, they just named this thing that I definitely did, and they explained why it's good. It's kind of like you can't deny that that's actually a piece of praise that's like meaningful. So that does make sense. I had one quick question I want to slip in here about praise, because we talked quite a bit about categories of praise types, and then we've also talked about specificity and generality. I wonder if you just have a quick comment on amount of praise. Is there like too much? Is there like a teacher that's sort of throwing out too much praise that it starts to get watered down? Or is it like too little where it's like, wow, you have to pry a praise comment from this teacher out of their jaw, you know, like.
That's an interesting question. We wrestled with this, right? We went back and forth about like, do we include a rate of praise? Because we were like, what do we include in this analysis? And like, how do you capture the potency, for lack of a better word, of the praise? Like, does it get diluted if it's 100 praises per second, right? If I'm just going super quickly. And then one of our teachers praised everything kind of at the end, we noticed. And we said, does it get diluted that way too? Because it happens so far away from the events. So this teacher would say, I noticed that all these groups did these things, and then in this 30-minute period, and praise at the end of this 30-minute group work session. And so I think that's a really great question. I don't think we have a magic number, but I think going back to what Jenny said about, I'm going to conceptualize it. We didn't analyze it this level. We did wrestle with it, but this idea around specificity and proximity to when it happened, I think, is going to be important, right? And so generic praise, like the good, tends to happen very quickly. And we kind of said in our discussion, we discussed this saying that sometimes served a different purpose than to kind of tell what was worthy. It was more just to move the lesson along sometimes. Maybe that was the case. And so going back to what Jenny said, I think good and good job serves a function, right? You want to just move the lesson along. You want to make people feel good so they can just go on with the next step. And so in that case, you may have a lot of peppering of these generic goods. But going back to the specificity, I do think the closer that happens to when the action happens, and then something is done after to build off of what was praised, like this assigning competence, if that idea is taken up in a group and then they work on it, that could be more potent, for lack of a better phrase again. So we didn't have a measure for potency, but I think you bring up a great point about not necessarily just doing a lot and not necessarily waiting to the end, but kind of doing it close to when the student actually did something that was praiseworthy.
I'll add briefly that I think sincerity is really important. If it's not sincere praise, I mean, kids can smell that. And one of the amazingly hard things about doing this kind of research is to pull out one tiny thread of what is a tapestry of classroom interactions. So I would say yes to everything that Kathy said. And I think you'd have to look at it in the broader context of everything that's going on with that teacher and those students as well. So, but yeah, I agree. I think that proximity and evidence for why the praise is coming all matter. Yeah. And it's probably going to be a function as much of how students like that teacher overall and feel supported by that teacher overall as well, is the only thing I'll add.
Another thing that I think we've been talking about from kind of how students are receiving it, which was interpretive on our part, I think from the teacher perspective, which is also interpretive from our part, but from my teacher education lens, it also really supports the teacher this noticing what we talked about earlier, right? So in addition to kind of the best practices for praise, it's also what does the teacher want to focus on in noticing about what Jenny said, the brilliance of what a student is saying, right? And so I think when I work with our teachers and the students that I work with, really supporting them to see that brilliance, and praise is a nice avenue to support that, right? So it's, what do I want to notice about students' thinking today or students' actions today that I can highlight? And it slows them down. So I think this idea of supporting teachers to slow down to notice the brilliance is kind of what praise might be able to do for teachers, right? And so in your question around how much and how often, it's really how often should this teacher be looking for that brilliance, right? And this is a venue that I've been able to support teachers and students to say, you got to slow down and see that brilliance, not just throw out a generic good, but slow down, specify what that brilliance is for yourself, because that makes us better teachers.
Along with all this, I'm now realizing one thing that we don't talk about is distribution, like who in the classroom is getting praised. And mm-hmm. So if the same kids are always getting the same praise, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
So I'm especially interested in the work that Neeral Shah and Dan Reinholtz are doing right now. They've got this EQUIP protocol that mm-hmm. provides teachers with snapshots of how their attention to students and student responses are being distributed. So I think that could be a really cool thing to look at within their own work, is who's getting praised and for what.
Yeah, that's a great connection and definitely an important thing to consider. And if listeners are interested, I did interview Neeral about that in episode 1817. So I think that's a great connection to make here too. But Kathy and Jenny, their article is in the Journal of Mathematical Behavior. Kathy coming to us from Santa Clara University and Jenny coming to us from the University of Oregon. Thanks for being here. Real quick before I let you go, so it sounds like you were both in grad school together. Was that at Stanford, if I remember correctly?
Correct.
Yep.
Yeah. And who were your advisors there?
Joe Bowler. Yeah,
the same advisor, Joe Bowler.
Okay. All right. It's all making sense. All coming together here. Jenny, you were on before, and I think I asked you what your alternative career might be. You can amend your answer if you want to, but I'm also curious to hear from Kathy. If you weren't in math education, what might you imagine as an alternative career?
It's hard to imagine anything right now outside of education. And the first thing that came to mind was, I love going to science museums and things. It's still education, it's STEM now. But I would love, and my retirement job is going to be, I hope, to work in a science museum and just watch and support kids learning. That's still education. So the one that's not math education would be, I think I'd want to be a baker, but I don't want to wake up early. I would just love to experiment with recipes and bake, but I would open my shop at like 11 a.m.
Just call it like the afternoon bakery or something like that. And that gets you off the hook.
That's great. that's a great name.
Jenny, how are you feeling these days about a possible alternative career?
I'm still diving. Okay. And the newest wrinkle for me is I realized that I could actually teach diving. And so
there you go.
Because it's hard to imagine leaving teaching and leaving working with kids, especially. So there you go. I just knit them together.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much for your work and for talking with us about it here.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening to what I have affectionately titled the Sunroof episode. If you're looking for additional podcasts related to math education, you should check out the Teaching Math Teaching podcast, one of the shows that's produced by the Association of Mathematics Teacher Educators. I was actually featured as a recent guest on Teaching Math Teaching with hosts Dusty Jones and Joel Amadon. I really enjoyed talking about my journey to becoming a math teacher educator and also some of the ways that my thinking and my approach to teacher education has changed in recent years. For example, I'm no longer convinced that it's productive to always lead with a robust, reform-oriented vision for math instruction. Maybe there are some more effective ways to incrementally move toward that new vision, but without first separating ourselves from the realities of conventional circumstances. Anyway, you can hear that conversation, as well as many other episodes with math teacher educators, on the Teaching Math Teaching podcast from AMTE. You can go to teachingmathteachingpodcast.com. And I'm also planning several more episodes on the Math Ed podcast in 2023, so keep your ear to this feed as well.